Welcome to Just JKing, the podcast where we transform your HR headaches into high fives. Whether you're a founder, CEO, or just someone with HR questions you're too afraid to ask, we've got the insights, laughs, and light bulb moments that you crave.
Enjoying the show? Hit that five-star review and subscribe now so you never miss out.
Welcome back to Just JKing with Jennifer and Kim.
I'm really excited to introduce our next guest, Roseanne DeLeo.
Roseanne is a seasoned human resources professional with extensive experience in labor relations. Spanning a career in both the public sector and the broader sector in Ontario, Roseanne has experience in dealing with a variety of unions and leading collective bargaining in various sectors, including social justice, healthcare, and not-for-profits. She holds a CHRL and a degree in labor management relations from the University of Toronto.
And on top of all of that, Roseanne has been teaching labor relations in the continuing education program at George Brown College since 2019. Welcome, Roseanne.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and excited to chat with you today, both Kim and Jennifer.
So we are dying to get into it. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up working with a specialization in labor relations. What is it about labor that kind of really revs you up?
So it is a passion of mine, and I would say I kind of fell into it a really long time ago, really early on in my career. I was working as an HR generalist, and I was handed a file where it said I had to lay off a number of unionized employees. And from that experience, what happened basically, rigid application of collective agreement language without any thought to impact had an adverse impact on the employees that it was actually served, you know, in theory, was supposed to protect, and it didn't. And I thought there had to be a better way. And just to give you an example of what actually happened, if you're interested.
Very interested.
Because it's really fascinating, actually. So there was a group of employees. They were working out of our Mississauga office. They were all female. They were middle-aged. They'd been working there a while, doing administrative work, processing accounts, part of the union. They had to be laid off. There was a budget crisis, and the collective agreement said, hey, when people are laid off, as long as they can be redeployed to another job with that met certain criteria, they had to take the job. And if they didn't take it, they would basically give up their rights to severance. Well, the job that was identified for these women, who, again, were really well educated, were to be cleaners at a psychiatric facility.
Wow.
In downtown Toronto, because it met the requirements, it met the pay scale, it was within 40 kilometers of where they lived and where they worked. And can you imagine? You're now telling, you know, somebody that you now have to be, you know, you're going to lose your job. And if you don't take this, you're now going to have no severance.
Gosh.
And that was disgusting. It was disgusting. Yeah. And nobody cared. It was like, nope, well, it meets the collective agreement. That's all we're required to do. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah. Sorry, let's go back a second, because I mean, the reason why unions came into play in the early 1900s to begin with was really about protecting the employees. And so what you're telling us is that sometimes by just following the letter of a collective agreement, it often doesn't protect the employees in your experience.
Oh, yeah. I've had lots of examples of that. When I teach this, I said, you know, there's lots of examples of when seniority or whatever it is doesn't actually protect the employees it's designed to protect.
Wow. And so as an employee, though, you're paying dues to the union in order to protect your rights. And in the situation that you just described, what happened with those employees who were professional employees asked to take on cleaning jobs? Like, what? How did that story end?
Well, so I left the organization because it was like such a bitter experience for me. So I thought I can't work for an organization that doesn't really, you know, embrace these employees and care about the employees. So those employees did not take those jobs. There was no way they were going to take those jobs. And they filed a grievance. So this is where the union does come in to protect them to some degree. They filed a grievance, and eventually it made its way to arbitration, where the arbitrator sided with them and said, yes, it might follow the letter of the law and the collective agreement, but does it actually make sense?
And Roseanne, given the fact that, as we already talked about, these agreements are put in place to protect employees, how do you feel that happened? Because when these things are drafted and agreed to initially, What, how in your mind did that escape the union's oversight, and why did they accept that deal?
Well, okay, so what I have to say about that. So I was working at a very large ministry, of the Ontario government at the time. And I was very young in my career, very junior. I did not negotiate collective agreements at that time. You have to remember, so it's a, the Ontario Public Service is a huge beast, it's a huge monster. And the collective agreements are no negotiated at the center. And they negotiate collective agreements on behalf of 60,000 employees. So they can't conceivably come up with every permutation. So they basically come up with a with language that by and large will, work for, the majority of the people there. But it doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't work in every circumstance. And there are ways to get around that. You can have a letter of understanding or a memorandum, memorandum of agreement with the union, say, yes, this is a language, but it doesn't make sense here. So let's talk about this. But I have to say back then it was management who said that these are the terms of collective agreement and we're following them. So, so sad, too bad.
I get that they were following the letter of the agreement. It kind of sounds like in that case, being part of such a large group is actually detrimental because it's not able to be nimble enough to accommodate what might be special circumstances in that larger group.
Exactly.
For many of our listeners who may not have exposure to unions or to labor relations, a lot of our listeners are in small and medium-sized companies. How would you describe the difference between an organization that is governed by a union in their collective bargaining versus an organization where there is not a union present? So what does that mean for business leaders? What would you say the key difference is?
Well, I think in a non-unionized environment, management has a lot more flexibility. In a unionized environment, you are negotiating with a third party. Not only do you have your employees to contend with, but then you have this third party who's also, negotiating on behalf of your employees. So it really limits your flexibility. And depending on what you negotiate, what language you put in the collective agreement, it could really restrict your management rights in terms of things you may want to do. It doesn't mean you can't do these things. It means that you have to talk to the union about it. You'll have to give notice. So it slows you down, is what I would say.
And what about from a cost perspective? Would you say that there is a difference in the cost to an employer in working in an environment where their employees are unionized versus not unionized?
Say it depends. I mean, if you read the text, I teach this, and if you read the textbooks, the theory is that you have labor peace for a number of years. You have a collective agreement, like let's say it's a 3-year agreement or 4-year agreement. During that time, employees have to work. There'll be no strikes or lockouts. You'll have labor peace. You will know what your budget envelope is because you've negotiated up front. So you know for the next 3 or 4 years exactly what you're going to be paying in terms of salary from that perspective. Employees are still required to work and be productive, and you can still performance management. Does the fact that the union is there in the first place drive up the cost to start with? I guess it depends on your industry. So I think the answer is it depends.
And what about, I mean, we see in the market there is a shift from a generational perspective to a lot more millennials and Gen Zs coming into the workforce, and the baby boomers and the Gen Xs are kind of coming to the last 10 or 15 years, let's say, of their careers. What is the trend right now with the younger generations, and how do they feel about being unionized and being represented by a third party in their employment?
It's a really good question. Again, it's a little hard to say. I would say that, the younger generation, they tend to be more mobile. They don't stick around. They don't stay in those jobs for, a longer period of time. They really want work-life balance. I'm just thinking, if you're hiring an employee into a unionized environment, they sometimes don't even know that they're in a unionized environment. They're being hired, the job is unionized, and they're getting these, union dues being deducted off their paycheck. So, like, what's this for? What does this mean? And I think they also think that, they want to be rock stars. They want to do great jobs. So they want to be able to negotiate their own salaries and their bonuses. Whereas in a collective agreement, you don't have that luxury because you have a union advocating, your general wage increase, every year, whatever that is. So, I mean, the unions. One of the things that unions are trying to do is, appeal to the younger generation, and whether they're doing that through social media or various fairs, ways to get younger people going to the high schools. That is one other thing. You know, also with people working remotely, they don't have the same access to people that they did before, right? And the people aren't necessarily all concentrated in one place anymore. So it's going to be a very interesting future as the baby boomers and the Gen Xers retire.
Yeah, so Roseanne, I think I also have a degree in industrial relations from U of T, which I try not to use because I think it's a very complicated area that I'm not particularly suited to. But a lot of people aren't aware that historically unions have actually been quite important to some advancements in
For sure.
the workforce. Mat leave, the Canada Post union has done tons of things in the past. But what do you think the unions need to do to really become relevant to this new generation, or to get everybody to have a better understanding that by existing, they do create benefits for the workforce, even if you don't directly realize it in your own role?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I talk about this with my students. Like, even if you've never, been in a union and you're never going to deal with a union, you actually enjoy a lot of the things just by being a worker in Ontario, like safe working conditions. You know, the Ontario Occupational Health and Safety Act was born out of, accidents and unions advocating, the fact the 40-hour work week, right?
Yeah.
That is something that unions advocated for. In the background, unions are also taking on broader issues outside of work. Like, they are really driving, the national affordable daycare, a national daycare policy. Sure, way back when in the 60s, universal health care, there would have been, it was an NDP government with the support of labor driving that. So there are lots of things that we, the CPP, the pension plan. All of these things that we kind of take for granted today as employees were largely advanced by unions. So
Yeah. And I've heard,
we can thank them for that.
yeah,
Right.
and I've heard people actually say, well, they don't serve a purpose anymore. But being on the non-unionized management side of things, I know that we still pay attention to what unionized employees are getting so that we try to match that
Sure.
so that, either we stay union-free, not in a union busting sense, but just philosophically try to match what unionized employees are getting. There's a really good example I heard of once where there were two similar businesses across the street from each other, and one was unionized and one was not. But inevitably, they always did the exact same things because they don't want people to cross the street. And so I think that's really an uninformed view
Right.
of
Was
what.
that Toyota and Ford?
No, it wasn't actually. It was in the hospitality industry,
Okay.
but and not in Ontario. But I think it's just I think it's sort of sad to me that people don't realize that they are still working behind the scenes to do good things for all workers, and they get
Right.
a little bit of a bad rap sometimes. I understand there are absolutely limitations and challenges in dealing with them, and
Yeah,
it's
for sure.
definitely not
And I would
perfect.
say, and for, they keep management honest to some degree.
Yes. Yeah, I would say that's right. To summarize, yeah.
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 So, but let's talk more about that. There is a stereotype about unionized employees who do only the bare minimum. I mean, the joke was Roseanne and I worked together in an organization where there was one union who did cleaning from 5 feet down and a different union who did the cleaning from 5 feet up. I mean, like the ridiculousness of kind of the history of how things came to be is a very long story, but when you just look at that at face value, it's kind of like, why can't one person clean both, the ceiling and the floor?
Classic.
Right, classic. So with that comes a lot of stereotypes. What is your reality in dealing with unionized employees, Roseanne? And would you agree with the stereotype or would you debunk it?
No, so I don't agree with the stereotype. There's always going to be a couple of bad apples that absolutely, that they are the stereotype. And I know, people, if you're driving in any street, in Toronto or on the whatever, on the 401, and you see, five or six people in their orange vest, standing there looking at something, and you're thinking, what are they doing? They're not moving. What are we paying our taxes to? But no, I would say, like, I've heard all of the stereotypes, like union breeds mediocrity, and there's some employees who do give unions a bad rap because they'll say things, I have seniority, you can't touch me, which is not true. You can. It's more complicated. It's more, you have to invest more time and energy. But I would say, by and large, the employees I've, had the pleasure to work with, and they have been mostly unionized, they are diligent, conscientious. They want to do a good job. The fact that they're in the union probably doesn't even cross their mind. It only crosses their mind when they're feeling mistreated by management, and then they have somebody to turn to. But then you might have, employees who are, rock stars and want to be able to, negotiate, a bonus or, better rewards that they can't. And they might feel a little hard done by being in the union. And then there are some people who will, because there's no reason to work any harder, they might just fly, just do the bare minimum. But I would
Got
say
it.
that those are the minority. And then it's the management problem.
So you've been teaching this topic for a while. What advice do you give your students that they won't find in a textbook? And what advice would you give to employers that they might not know?
Well, so what I often say to my students, and it's not in a textbook, something I learned really, really early on, somebody said to me, management gets the union it deserves. I don't know if you've heard that before, but management gets the union it deserves. So if you're treating your employees poorly, whether or not you're discriminating, harassing, or just being unfair, inherently unfair, you're going to get probably a union that's going to come in and be pretty militant because they're going to try and, fix it on behalf of employees. So what I would tell employers, if you want to stay union free, then the best advice I can give you is don't give your employees a reason to unionize, right? In the first place. And the reasons employees unionize, they unionize for a number of reasons. And pay is not, it might be one, but it's at the bottom of the list. The reason employees unionize because perceived unfairness, inequity, workload issues, they're being, worked too hard, maybe unsafe working conditions that aren't being addressed. And one of the big ones is an ineffective complaints process. If they have an issue and they're bringing it to you and you're not doing anything about it, they feel like they're not being heard. And these are the reasons that employees tend to unionize. So if you're an employer and you want to, avoid that, then do all the right things.
So let's talk about flexibility a little bit, Roseanne, because the length of collective agreements when technology was progressing more slowly was probably pretty reasonable when we weren't in rapid inflation. Then an example of like video editors come to mind, which were really, cutting film at one point, and then you can imagine how much that has changed from that point to where we are now. Jobs become obsolete, skills become obsolete a lot faster. What's being done in this realm to sort of keep up with the pace of change a little bit better when you're typically used to, 3 to 5 year agreements and that's it. What, expecting things to be the same 5 years from now is completely unrealistic at this point.
Absolutely, I totally agree with that. And I would say that collective agreements typically, I think that they're typically still about 3 years, 2 to 3 years tends to be typical. But I think you have to remember, and as you said, when you're negotiating a collective agreement, you're negotiating at a point in time, right? And that point in time is informed by past events, right? So you don't have a crystal ball. Now, the best example I could give of that is COVID. We had collective agreements that were in play, and then COVID happened. Nobody anticipated COVID and what that would mean for the workforce and what we were going to do. There was no language in the collective agreement to say how are you going to treat employees. But that is the beauty of things called memorandums of understanding and letters of agreement, where an unanticipated event happens where you say, okay, this is happening. We now need to figure out what we're going to do and enter into a time-limited, letter of understanding to deal with this particular situation. And if it, and it goes on, post the next round of bargaining, then we can talk about it during the collective agreement process. But in terms of jobs disappearing, Jennifer, most collective agreements do have language that talks about technological change. So the unions understand that things don't always stay stagnant, things do change. And, jobs do disappear. And I guess the big question is, how do you treat the employees that are impacted by those disappearing jobs? Are you going to retrain them, or you're going to lay them off and give them severance? And what does that look like? How much notice will they get? So typically, collective agreements have that kind of language.
Realistically, I understand those are the pragmatic solutions to that issue. How easy is it to actually implement those solutions when it comes down to like any specific examples you can think of? Was it easy to get the understanding? Was it easy to like
So I would say it really depends on the level of relationship, the maturity of your relationship with your bargaining agent. So if you're working together in a, collaborative, collegial way, then yes, it's easy. I think the best, healthiest relationships between employers and unions, if they both understand They're working towards the same objective as we want happy, healthy employees. We may not always agree on how we get there, maybe, but at the end of the day, that's what we're both, aspiring for. So if the objective is the same, then it's pretty easy to get, to get aligned. The language might be a little different. They want mine a little this or a little that. Certainly, employers always want to maintain as much flexibility as possible. Then unions want to probably limit that flexibility, but there's always a balance that, everybody can live with. But if your relationship is, one of mistrust and disrespect, it's going to be significantly harder.
Yeah, so I'm curious now that you say that, if you were an HR person coming into a labor relations role and that was the history, what do you do to sort of reform that relationship to get it into a more positive place? I mean, that's a huge question, I realize, but is there anything that you can give us off the top of your head that would help? Because I think that probably happens a lot. People come into a bargaining arrangement that they're new to, it's got a bad history. They maybe want to move the dial on that if they can. What are some suggestions that you would have?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, anytime I go into a new workplace or somewhere I'm asked, by somebody to help them out, the first thing I do is call up the bargaining agent. Like, who is that? Who do I have to establish a relationship with? I need to do, some consultation. I need to build trust. They need to know that they can trust me. And you just have to keep working at it.
Takes a while, I would
It
imagine.
absolutely takes a while. But you also, want to build trust with the employees that the union represent. They're your employees. So you want to make sure that you're acting in a way that, you're transparent, you're ethical, you're fair, and you're perceived as such. Because if the employees have that impression of you, then, it's going to be easier for the union rep to also, support you and work with you.
Yeah, I suppose in many ways it's no different. I mean, it's a little bit more complicated because there's more parties involved, but it's no different than coming into a new HR role, like a general role where HR maybe wasn't super good at advocating or for employees or had very low trust. I think we've probably
Right.
all been in that situation too, and
Yes.
you just kind of have to pick away at it one situation at a time, almost earn the trust back one person at a time, I would
Exactly.
say. Yeah, interesting.
So, Roseanne, I've heard of situations where an organization becomes unionized under leadership, and then that leadership ultimately gets terminated as a result of it, because that's seen as an ultimate failure.
Right.
Tell us then, in those situations, how can a leadership team remain union-free? And I think you spoke a little bit about trust, transparency. Like, tell us more about what you see in organizations that are very effective in remaining union-free.
So I think what I would say is, you need to treat your employees well. Like, don't, like I said earlier, do not give them, a reason to unionize. When you're putting in policies, it's really easy for people, in HR or, the leadership team who aren't, on the front lines putting in a policy without consulting the people who it's actually going to impact on the ground. And we hear that a lot. And I, the last time a group became unionized, and what they said to us is what we really, the reason we unionize is because we want a voice at the table. We care about money and all those other things, but what we really cared about, nobody's listening to us. We want a voice at the table. So we think this is how we had to, go about it, because this is the only way you'd get us to listen to you. They weren't happy about some of the policies that were actually introduced by previous leadership that the existing leadership had to deal with. And I'm not going to get into details. And because nobody would listen to them, and there was no, and they didn't have, like I said, an effective complaints process. So now, well, the only way I'm going to get you to listen to me is to have, a third party do this. And now you're going to be forced. By law, you're going to be forced to have to listen to me.
Right. So then, some of the tips for remaining union free would then include having a great complaints process, allowing employees the opportunity to collaborate, and being more transparent
Be
and
more transparent. Like I said, people, they care about pay, but it's not the thing that drives them to unionize. All your executives are getting all kinds of bonuses, and on the backs of employees who are, making very little, that might drive people to want to unionize. But by and large, it's because people aren't feeling that they're being treated fairly.
there's also a perception that you need to be a very large employer in order to be, in order for there to be a threat of a union. Is that true?
No, I had lunch yesterday with somebody I know, and she is the head of a 50 person organization, and 20 of their employees just unionized.
Wow.
So no, that is not true.
So this really impacts everybody. And so for small and medium-sized businesses who may think that this is not an issue that they need to learn more about, what you're saying is that's not at all true.
No, it can impact any size.
They were hoping. Now we've just terrified them.
I would say it's probably more prevalent in the public sector that those smaller employers get unionized. I mean, unions are also very good about doing a cost-benefit analysis of, what's it going to cost us as an organization to have to represent, a small group of people versus a larger group of people. Do the dues that we collect make it worth it for us? At the end, unions are businesses too.
So talk to us a little bit more about that. And so obviously, knowing that you've always worked on the employer side and not on the union side, and I'm not going to suggest that you can represent unions or how it is that they think or what their business model is, but the fact that they are a business and they have a vested interest in the collective bargaining process, they have a vested interest when they are negotiating with an employer on behalf of an employee. How does the employee ensure that they are being well represented?
So it's interesting, before you even get to the collective bargaining table, there's a sub process of negotiation that goes on, and that's within your own team because you want to make sure when you're at the table that you're aligned. So the union will do exactly what the employer will do. The union will survey their members. They will have, meetings and town halls and talk to people about what's important to them so that they can't be all things to all people. But they can get the major themes, and management will do the same on that side, and they'll come to the table and make sure that everybody's aligned. But remember, unions exist. The employees are paying union dues, and those are automatically deducted from people's paychecks. So that's how the unions survive in Canada, whereas in the US, employees it's left up to the employees as to whether or not they want to pay union dues or not. So a lot of unions just, go by the wayside because they can't afford to exist anymore. But in Canada, but the unions use that money to fund things like, your legal representation, if you're filing a grievance, if you're an employee, advocacy, education, all kinds of things that they do. So, but they're a business. And interestingly enough, a lot of the really large unions, they have their what they call their staff reps or business agents. They themselves are unionized by another union.
Oh. And
It's
so, if
not
I'm an
uncommon. So unions are also employers of unionized employees.
that's fascinating.
I am part of the management team. I am a leader within an organization, and my employees have approached me and told me that they would like to remove the union. What can I do, and what can I not do to help them, Roseanne?
You can't do anything to help them. You have to stay completely out of it. As management, you cannot be seen to be colluding with them. That would be considered an unfair labor practice under the Labor Relations Act. You can say to them, "I, as management, I'm not allowed to help you. You should probably, call a labor lawyer."
And what else can be considered an unfair labor practice? What other types of situations should we be advising our clients to steer clear of?
Before you answer that, Roseanne, can I add to it that we still continuously see incidents of union busting and stuff come up in the press? Companies are getting into trouble doing it. Everybody knows this. What? Why? Why do they insist on doing things that they know is are an unfair labor practice? It's very clear. The law is very clear on it.
The law is very clear. I think they don't care. I think some of
Why?
the, well, you know, their Walmart in Mississauga,
Yeah.
really recently became unionized. It was the second store actually in Canada that became unionized. The first store, I think, was out in Saskatchewan a few years ago. And as soon as it became unionized, Walmart just up and closed the store and left that province. So, Walmart is a very good case study about, anti-union sentiment, right? It's an
Yeah.
American chain. And I imagine, I don't know anything about what went on at Walmart in Mississauga, but I imagine that their leadership has probably all been turfed because they allowed this to happen. So why do they do it? Jennifer, I wish I knew why they did it. Yes, it's illegal. They think they can get away with it. I think they just buy time, right? They can just, if they do it, then it's through the court process. It's in the legal system, and that can drag out for years and years.
Right. Okay. So it's just like a cost benefit analysis on their part. They're like,
I think it's a
well,
strategy.
we'll get in trouble. We'll get some bad press. We'll wait it out. How, or like maybe I'm wondering if it's US teams thinking, how bad can it be? They're Canadians. What are they going to do to
Maybe.
us?
You're so nice.
Okay. So back to Kim's question, which was, what are some other common unfair labor practices that you see?
So if you're in a non-unionized environment, you don't have to worry about unfair labor practices unless it's unless you come to know that your employees are now thinking about unionizing. So as soon as you have that knowledge, there are certain things you can and cannot do as an employer. And I would say that as soon as you discover that your employees are thinking about unionizing, get on the phone and call your labor lawyer. Not your real estate lawyer, not your intellectual property lawyer. You need to call a labor lawyer who will tell you exactly what can and can't be done. And it's not a fair and it's not a fair fight, because the unions can say a lot during an organizing campaign, and employers can say very little. And if you say anything, it can get you into a lot of trouble, and you'll find yourself in front of the labor board. So you can't make any changes. You can't make any promises or threats. You can't say, hey, if you don't join the union, we won't lay anybody off. Or, hey, if you do join the union, it's going to increase our costs, and we're going to have to lay everybody off. Those are things that you cannot say as the employer. And when I say the employer, it means anybody on your management team. Anybody cannot say these things. So you really need to train all of your managers as to what can and cannot be said. It doesn't mean that you can't say anything, but you just have to be really careful about, what and how you say.
Have your lawyer draft it. Have your labor lawyer
Have
draft
your lawyer do
that
a tip
check.
sheet, do's and don'ts. Have your lawyer do, Q's and A's, what you can and can't say, for sure.
Not
And
worth it.
so,
Roseanne, you said when your employees are thinking about unionizing, I mean, how the heck am I supposed to know as a business
You're
leader
fine.
what my
No,
employees are
when I
thinking?
say thinking, because somebody will tell you, because somebody who is loyal to the employer, there's also going to be somebody saying, hey, last night I went to so and so's house and we had dinner and there was a presentation by Union X, right?
Got it. So it's the fact that there's already conversations happening amongst
Happening. That's
employees.
when the yes. So you
Got
so
it.
once you hear the conversations are happening, you cannot intervene. You cannot interfere. You can, they have the the Charter of Rights gives them the freedom to associate. And so if you're intervening in any way, even if you want to help, stay away. It's actually considered collusion.
So we've all heard horror stories about managers not being able to terminate unionized employees. What's the truth? What are you seeing?
So the truth is, well, okay, the thing I'm going to say as a manager, or two managers, I'm going to say, in collective agreements, I've never seen a collective agreement that does not have a probationary period. And that probationary period exists to protect the managers. One of the very few things that exist to protect the managers. So use it. Use your probationary period. And I can't tell you how many times a manager has called me the day, one day before the probationary period is set to expire, to say, I want to get rid of so and so. I'm like, And does so and so know that they're not doing a good job? And how have you been helping so and so, do a good job? Have you been providing training and coaching and mentoring? Do they have the tools and resources to do their job? Like, no. It's like, So now you want to terminate this employee. So what I say to managers is, you've got the probationary period, use it. It's your opportunity to make sure to determine whether or not whoever you've hired has the skills and competencies and behaviors to do the job that you've hired them to do. And if you're, communicating right through the process, then you can actually terminate that employee, and likely will not be subject to the grievance procedure. So number one, I would say that to managers, my advice to managers. But let's say you're a new manager, you've inherited, staff that have been there for years, then you have, a crappy employee and you're trying to get rid of them for whatever reason. Is it impossible? No. Is it difficult? Absolutely. It requires a lot of time, effort, attention, and a lot of managers just give up because it's hard. There is the progressive discipline process that you have to dot your I's and cross your T's, because your action, if you do terminate an employee, will undoubtedly be grieved by the employee, and with support from the union. It will then go to a third party arbitrator who will then determine whether or not you acted reasonably as an employer. Did you act within the terms of the collective agreement? And here's what's really important, that in a unionized firm, arbitrators have the right to reinstate an employee who's been terminated, and has the right to reinstate them with back pay, depending on if they think the employer acted in a manner that was egregious or inappropriate. Whereas in a non-unionized environment, you can terminate employees at any time for any reason, provided you're not, violating the human rights code. You know, it's just a matter of how much you pay them to leave, right? And there's no, I mean, they guess they can take it to court, but that's a lengthy and very expensive process. And a judge does not have the right to reinstate you. So in some ways, arbitrators have a lot more power. So if you're going to do a termination, you want to make sure it sticks.
And so we also hear quite a bit about the talk about seniority
Yeah.
within unionized environments.
Oh yeah.
And so, in an environment where we really have a commitment to equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging, how does that reconcile with the idea that seniority rules within unionized environments?
So seniority does rule within unionized environments. I mean, it is their be all and end all. It is, you know, for them, it is an objective measure. The longer you've been, you know, in the union, in theory, the more protection you have. But the reality is, you know, if you've been really deliberate about diversifying your workforce and increasing your representation of equity deserving groups, the reality is that some of these people are the most junior people that have come in, right? So if you're going to be doing something like a layoff, these are the people that likely have the least seniority. Or if there's language in the collective agreement that says if there's some kind of a promotional opportunity, the person with the most seniority gets it if they're relatively equal, that then that really kind of limits opportunities for people who are part, you know, members of these equity serving groups. So it's a bit more complicated. It's not impossible, but you have to be really intentional about it with the union and have some, maybe you have a side agreement about saying, okay, we're going to protect these, you know, these certain jobs that these certain people are going to be in the event that something is going to happen. So, and this is a true story. So two women working in the same unit for years. So one has, let's just say one has 20 years seniority and the other one has 19 years seniority. But the collective agreement says that the person with the most seniority in this unit, basically always gets first dibs on vacation. So, and I'm not lying. So this person who always had first dibs, they worked together for years, always had first dibs on vacation. So this other woman with 19 years seniority never got Christmas off, never got March break off, never got a PA day off because the other person always pulled this card. It's like, so how did this woman ever, you know, feel seen or embraced by the organization,
Right.
right? Or even by her union at that point. So again, here's the language that's supposed to protect people, but in the end, it didn't do anything for her. I mean, ultimately, I
Right.
was able to negotiate that language out and say, no, we need a process that's like fair to everybody.
Right. But even in thinking about, equity legislation that's come into play here in Ontario or across Canada and many states in the US is relatively new, let's say within the last 10 to 15 years, maybe the last 20 years. Also, a focus on really diversifying and our understanding as employers and as HR practitioners about how diversification of your employee base really helps to drive performance. So, with that being said, like you said, a lot of this diversity hiring or a lot of the idea of going out and being intentional about being diverse in your employees and
Yeah.
making sure that there is diversity amongst employees is relatively new and maybe not the people who have the most seniority. And so, how does that play against human rights legislation here in Ontario in particular? If you're doing a mass termination and everybody being terminated may be somebody who is either a person of color or a woman or an underrepresented group of some other kind.
Yeah, and that absolutely can happen if your layoff language in the collective agreement says that, you know, the people that will be laid off, it's going to be in order of reverse seniority, and the people that you've, you know, your most junior people of people that you've hired may be from these groups. Absolutely. So it is something that, you know, you need to be aware of. You need to make the union aware of it, and you have to say, you know, we need to do something about this. Exactly what? I've actually never had that situation yet. Luckily, I have not had to do any mass terminations for a very long time.
But
So,
as organizations are renegotiating collective agreements, are you starting to see some new themes and some new topics coming up to be negotiated at the table that may not have been negotiated previously, or?
the only thing I saw re I've done recently is, you know, there's language around the employer and the union together can apply to the Human Rights Commission for a special dispensation to have, you know, to basically, you know, recruit for from a specific group. So we want to say must have experience, lived experience as an X person, right? So by doing that, you're basically not considering other people.
So when you say an X person, we're talking about from a.
So, lived experience as an Indigenous employee, for example.
Got it. Okay. So thanks so much, Roseanne, for joining us today. But before we end the episode, there's a segment that we do with all of our guests. And so I've got one question for you, which is, what's the one thing that you believe businesses today can do to change the game for their people?
So one of the things I think business can do if they're not doing it already is, having a leadership team that leads with empathy. One of the, big things I'm a big supporter of, leading with empathy, treating our people as people, not as numbers, and getting to know them because, we talk about equity, diversity, and inclusion and bringing our whole self to work. Well, if we're going to really do that, we need to really understand who those people are. There's a book that I love, called Leaders Eat Last, which it's Simon Sinek, I think is his last name, which really talks about leadership and basically treating people with empathy, in a nutshell. And these people come to you and they are your employees and they spend a lot of time with you. Not, I don't want to say they are your family, but they spend a lot of hours of the day working with you and for you. So you want to make sure that you're treating them appropriately.
I love that. All right. And now on to rapid fire questions.
Okay.
All right. You ready for it?
I'm ready.
What was your first job?
My very first job that I was paid for, I was in high school. I was coordinating their 75th anniversary. So I did a lot of the clerical work related to the anniversary of that particular, of my high school at the time.
Your first job was at a high school.
Yes.
Excellent.
It was like for 2 weeks or something. And shortly after that, I got a job as a cashier in a supermarket that I left very quickly after that. I realized that I was not cut out for that. I was not a good cashier.
Interesting. Your best job.
My best job is probably the job I have now, I would think. I've spent a lot of time building up my career and I'm in a leadership position and I work with a fabulous team of people. I lead about a team of about 30 people right now as the chief human resources officer for a small, well, not a small, for actually a large public agency. So I, have had the privilege to work with an incredible team of HR professionals, but also with an incredible leadership team as well.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Biggest mess up at work.
My biggest mess up at work, I would say, looking back, I think, I've learned this, along the way is not believing everything you hear, so basically hearing somebody tell you something and taking that at face value without having heard, different perspectives.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, super important.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I learned that early on in my career.
Any
I'm
good
back. Yeah, I mean,
stories?
I can give you an example. I was working in a hospital and one of the doctors who worked there came to me. I was, in HR and was livid that, it was him, his secretary was taking so much time off and was completely livid and had me believing that she was defrauding the organization, that she, so I, looked into this, had called her into my office to have a conversation with her. And she looked at me and just go and basically said, I'm using my vacation time. I don't understand what's going on. And he was just, and think, wait a minute. And he was just livid that, the hospital, she was under the hospital policy of getting whatever, 3 to 4 weeks vacation. And he did not understand that she was entitled to this when I had to loop back with him.
I know it's supposed to be rapid fire, but I have a hilarious story about that. I once had a law firm partner accuse the cleaner of stealing a piece of artwork, and same deal, had me ready to go like right to the ends of the earth to prosecute this person. And it ended up that another partner in the law firm thought he was entitled to hang it on his wall and had taken it.
Oh God.
I think most of these people are deceased by now, so like,
Right.
they'll remain anonymous, but
Anonymous, yeah.
yeah, they were convinced, he was just convinced that, there was something totally going
Right. But
on.
it
And
was
of
missing. So
course,
it must have been the cleaner. There couldn't have
yeah,
been
of course it
a
was the
different
cleaner. It
explanation.
was a fellow partner who had just felt like, huh, I like that. I think I'll put it in my office, which,
Right.
they all own it. They're entitled to do, but yeah. I also, that was my first year working. So important lessons.
Best learning, Roseanne.
I think it was, and I talked about this earlier when I said, management gets the unions it deserves. I think that was probably an eye-opener for me when I was starting out in my career, in terms of how you treat people, irrespective of they're in the union or not, is really going to set the tone for how successful your organization is going to be, and how attractive your organization is going to be to people to want to come work there.
And quickest quit.
My quickest quit,
And you have to see it 5 times fast. Quickest quit.
well, I would say, I mean, certainly I think I only lasted as a cashier for about 4 months. But in my HR world, probably, I mean, the job I hated, I was working for a charitable organization. At the time, they were going through some significant change, and the leadership at the time, I don't think they had the skills to manage at the time. So question some of the ethics sometimes was not so, I was paid well, but pay is not everything. And I was very unhappy in that job. So,
So hard. Pay is nothing when you feel compromised. You
Exactly.
know, you would do anything to get out of a situation where you feel like ethically
Yeah,
or
I mean,
morally compromised.
exactly. If somebody said, "I'll pay you
Take
$1 million,"
note.
then go back to that environment. I would say, no, thank you. It's
Yeah.
not about the pay. And
Yeah.
I realized then, when you're miserable in your job, you're actually it, trickles down to the rest of your life, and you're miserable, with your family, with your partner.
Yeah, it changes you. I've been in that situation too, where I just didn't recognize myself anymore. And I thought, well, who are you? Like, and what's causing this? Yeah, that's so important. I think that's really important for people earlier in their HR career to hear too. That's okay. You might come across that situation, in which case,
Get
it's
out.
fine. Yeah.
Well, and I have a situation that I can describe where the ethics of an organization that I worked at were in question. And after I left the organization, some former employees had reached out to me, and it actually painted a brush on me, and my ethics were being questioned. So, not broadly, but these particular people who may have been terminated in that organization or left on their own volition came to me and said, we thought you were part of it. So for HR people in particular, it's really important that we remember that if we are standing by, and support, in an organization where decisions are being made that we really don't agree with, it often can blow back on us.
And your reputation. So
And
it's
your
so important.
reputation. And I mean, I joke about that all the time. Like, we don't sell anything in HR. All we have is a reputation, and
That's
all we
right.
have is our own integrity. And so you got to protect that at all, at all costs, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah, totally. That's so important. Can't learn that early enough. Stay true to yourself, or you will lose who you are.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Just JKing. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and took away some valuable insights to shake up your own HR game.
If you love this episode, and we hope you did, make sure to hit that subscribe button, leave us a review, and share it with your network. We want to hear your thoughts, your feedback, and even your own wild HR stories.
And don't forget to connect with us on LinkedIn or drop us a message. Let us know what topics you want us to dive into next.
Until next time, keep it real, keep it human, and always keep JKing.
We'll see you next time on Just JKing. Thanks for listening.